You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, we'll talk about Wisconsin's need for IT workers and an event in Northeast Wisconsin that's trying to help fill it. First, Wisconsin's juvenile prisons are slated to shut their doors by 2021, according to a law passed last year. But Governor Tony Evers wants to delay the closure, saying that more time and money is needed. In addition, the governor's forthcoming budget proposal is reported to include bonding to close these prisons. It'll also call for money to add staff at Lincoln Hills and increase pay for employees. Patrick Marley is a politics and state house reporter for the Milwaukee Journal-Sentinel. Patrick, welcome back to the show.
Thanks for having me on, Rob.
Well, Patrick, you've been following this story really since it broke. What do you make of this delay? What's going on with this proposed delay in the schedule of closing Lincoln Hills?
It's a little unclear exactly how long of a delay we're going to be looking at. Some of the lawmakers who put together the bill that is closing Lincoln Hills had said at the early stages of this session that they would need to extend the timeline to get everything done in time. And then after that, there was a meeting among lawmakers and some people from the administration, and apparently the message at that meeting was that they may need as much as 2 years more to close it, which would be 4 years from today. And so that's caused some consternation, particularly among Republican lawmakers. But it's unclear exactly what they'll settle on as for what kind of timeline they need to shut this facility down.
Now, the backstory, long-running concerns about abuse or neglect of the juveniles at this facility, concerns for the safety of the people who work at Lincoln Hills in particular. Patrick, talk about what the plan is to move from Lincoln Hills and Copper Lake to what? What is it we're trying to get ready in this time span?
So right now there's about 140 kids who stay at Lincoln Hills and Copper Lake. That's down considerably from past years. The idea is that they want to get these kids into much smaller facilities and ones that are closer to their homes. So you might have two or three dozen young people staying at these facilities. Some would be run by the state for the really the most serious offenders. Some would be run by the counties. Those facilities could also hold people who have been found to have committed very serious crimes as well. And then you could have some say, right now the facility is north of Wausau, very far from southeastern Wisconsin, where many of these youth come from. You could put one in or near Milwaukee. There would be expanded facility in Madison and then maybe some other places around the state. The advocates and legislators say this is a better way to provide services, that you have them more connected with their family, and you can have a better staff to inmate ratio and provide sort of one-on-one counseling and more services to them.
So how are we doing on this? What plans are afoot to actually have a site for these facilities, have staffing, put them in place?
So last year, the state agreed to pay $19 million to one inmate who had attempted suicide, did not die, but was severely mentally impaired from because she wasn't able to breathe and her heart had stopped for a long period of time. And so that suddenly, after there had been a lot of hand-wringing in the legislature about what to do about Lincoln Hills, that sort of seemed to get things moving. They agreed to close it by 2021 and provided $80 million in funding for these county-run facilities. And now the question seems to be that they think they need more time and they need more money for these new facilities. They haven't indicated where specifically these facilities will be, so they need to identify a location and then they need to build them.
Talking to Patrick Marley from the Milwaukee Journal-Sentinel with the latest news on plans to replace what are currently the state's main youth prisons for boys and girls. Patrick, now we're hearing that the governor in his budget is planning to include more funding for staffing, better pay for the staff at Lincoln Hills and Copper Lake while they're still in operation. What do we know about staffing conditions and the treatment of inmates there? Has anything improved?
Lincoln Hills continues to suffer from a big staff shortage. That's true at many correctional facilities. I guess there's been a particular spotlight on Lincoln Hills, but you've got many adult institutions that have very large, what they call vacancy rates. So positions that are empty, which can be as many as one in five. And obviously when you have a position that isn't filled, you have to take the existing staff and make them work more. So a lot of people are put into situations where they, as soon as they come to the end of an eight-hour shift, they're informed they have to work another one. And this can happen many days in a row, and staff get burnt out. And, you know, they're dealing with a difficult population, whether they're adults or young people. One solution that has been proposed from both the administration and lawmakers is to pay workers more money so that you can attract more workers and keep them once you get them. The governor's indicated he's going to do that in his budget. We don't know how big of an increase it'll be. Correctional officers have gotten some wage increases in recent years. It hasn't been enough to stem this problem.
And it seems like one unique challenge here is it's got to be hard to hire people to work at a job that they know is finite. It's going to end whether it's 2021 or a couple years later. Anybody they hire, it's a limited term job.
Yes, however, we haven't really seen the problem get worse since they said that they were closing Lincoln Hills. I mean, it was in the worker shortage was a problem before, and it continues to be a problem. I don't know that we've seen it worsen. It does appear that Lincoln Hills will have a life after it is no longer a juvenile facility. It seems like there's a strong possibility that that facility will become an adult institution. And everyone who works there now has been guaranteed a different state job when it does close. So whether, you know, if it's a new adult facility, they could work there, or they could be relocated to another facility elsewhere. Now, that may mean some people have to move and some people might not want to do that. So it definitely adds to the job security concerns that employees might have there.
And Patrick, you mentioned that there are fewer youth now at Lincoln Hills in Copper Lake. Why is that?
Judges have made a concerted effort to put fewer people there. You know, usually, in most cases, you are sent there. It's determined by a judge, probably in all cases, it's determined by a judge. And there's some discretion as to whether to keep them in a local facility, whether to keep them on home monitoring. And so with all of the controversy about Lincoln Hills, there's been an effort to send fewer there. And that's what's happening.
And what, Patrick, as we wrap up, do we know about conditions, safety there for inmates, residents, and the staff?
So there was a lawsuit. There's been a lot of lawsuits over Lincoln Hills. One of them was brought by the ACLU and representing inmates who were there. And that state settled that, and as a condition of that, had to have an independent monitor check in on the facility on a regular basis. We got the first report recently on that. And the independent monitor raised some concerns about the facility there, that the inmates weren't being given enough time to be in class, and they weren't getting enough programming, that the rooms were not suicide resistant, which is obviously a concern because I told you about that situation where a girl attempted suicide and nearly died. So there continue to be a number of problems.
Patrick, thanks a lot for bringing us up to date.
Thank you.
That's Patrick Marley, politics and state house reporter for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. He joined us with the latest on what's happening to juvenile prisons, Lincoln Hills and Copper Lake. Coming up, a training event in northeastern Wisconsin is trying to build the state's pipeline of professionals to work in information technology. We'll talk to one of the organizers coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, we'll talk about a program that's trying to fill a need for IT professionals here in the state. Right now, it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Maureen McCollum with a dive into the Wisconsin song.
I recently received a question from a listener, Antoinette. She asked, why doesn't Wisconsin have a song? There isn't a single song that I hear and think, good old Wisconsin. This question got my head spinning. Is there a song that represents or unifies our state's diverse music fans? Probably not. But I decided to turn this question to some Wisconsin music journalists and hosts and find out what they thought is the Wisconsin song.
I'm going to open my program tonight with a little number that's quite a favorite with all my friends back in my hometown, Milwaukee.
I'm Allison Geyer, staff writer for Isthmus Newspaper. My choice is the song Beer Barrel Polka, Cats played all over the state at sporting events and weddings and Oktoberfest celebrations. Probably the most Wisconsin version of all is performed by Liberace. His version is a weird, charming mix of Wisconsin's most iconic cultural contributions.
I'm Tom Giffey with Volume 1 magazine in Eau Claire, and the song that comes to my mind is Wisconsin, recorded by Glenn Yarborough.
There's the town.
You may remember it as the theme to North Country Notebook, a WPR show from about 30 years ago. I can't hear it without thinking of my public radio listening father and the Wisconsin that we both knew.
And I wanted you to see the old Wisconsin that I knew.
Hi, this is Christopher Paulus. A song that makes me think of Wisconsin? It's an intertribal song. An intertribal song is played at powwows, and it's an invitation for everybody to dance. And what makes me think of Wisconsin? Powwow time and intertribal songs. This one is by The Tribe, a group made up of many Native nations from across Indian country.
Hello. I'm Justin Barney. I'm the music director at 88.9 Radio Milwaukee. I think the artist is our very own Justin Vernon, a.k.a. Boney Bear. It sounds like a cabin in up north Wisconsin. So I know that it's going to create a little bit of controversy because he's relatively new. And the song itself doesn't say Wisconsin in it or talk about the state directly. But I think Skinny Love by Bon Iver encapsulates the feeling of being in and being from Wisconsin.
And I'm told you to be patient, and I'm told you to be fine.
Opinions aside, Wisconsin actually has an official state song.
On Wisconsin, plunge right through that line.
On Wisconsin was written by Carl Beck and William Purdy in 1909.
Purdy was a musician, and he found out that the University of Minnesota was having a contest for a new football song for there. And so he wrote the song for Minnesota originally.
That's David Knoll, the former director of university archives.
So instead of On Wisconsin, it would be Minnesota, Minnesota. But Beck convinced him to, instead of submitting it for the contest at Minnesota, to give it to or use it at the University of Wisconsin.
Those lyrics were heavy on the football lingo, and it's still used today at UW games to pep up the fans. But in 1959, the Wisconsin State Legislature declared On Wisconsin the official state song. This version has more, shall we say, dignified lyrics.
We, thy loyal sons and daughters, hail thee good and great.
Or people say, oh, On Wisconsin is the state song, but I expect if you ask lots of people to do the actual official lyrics of the official state version, they wouldn't get very far.
This story came from an audience question as part of the Wisconsin Project. Submit your question and we might answer it in a future Wisconsin Life segment. Go to WPR.org/Wisconsin. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and Wisconsin Public Television in partnership with the Wisconsin Humanities Council. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. I'm Maureen McCollum.
When I'm out walking, I strut my stuff.
Now, Governor Tony Evers has made February Career and Technical Education Month in Wisconsin to shine a light on how the state is getting students ready for jobs or college. In Northeast Wisconsin, there's an effort to get people ready for one field that's in high demand, information technology. Training happens once every year. It's part of an international program called the Hour of Code. Julie Eben-Matsky is the Associate Dean of Information Technology at Northeast Wisconsin Technical College in Green Bay. The campus recently hosted their fourth Hour of Code event a couple months ago. Julie, welcome to Central Time.
Well, thank you for having me.
Well, before we get into the Hour of Code itself, Julie, can you talk about the demand? Are there a lot of decent jobs out there in the information technology, IT fields?
Absolutely. Just here in Northeast Wisconsin, there is just more than 6,200 open positions in computer jobs. And just recently, within the last couple of weeks, U.S. News reported that software developer is the number one ranked job for 2019. So we have this growing trend of a shortage of IT professionals, and we need to fill that gap of how we train people in that field.
And have you seen this as kind of part of your mission there at Northeast?
Absolutely. We have employers that are constantly coming here asking us to be able to talk to our graduates. Many times trying to get the graduates before they even graduate from college, because they're good paying wages. The average salary is $75,000 for these careers in IT, so it's a great field to get into.
Now, we just stumbled across this Hour of Code event. We were a little late to the game. It happened in December, the most recent one, as I understand it. Tell us a little bit about what happened there.
Absolutely. So we do this annually. This was our fourth year, like you said earlier. Our first year, we had 12 people show up. This year, we had over 300.
Wow.
The thing we did unique this year was we decided not to just have it in Green Bay, where our main campus is, but we had it throughout our entire district all at the same time. So as far north as Niagara and Aurora, and then all the way down to Green Bay to Door County, and we decided to take it out to the rural areas this time. And what happens at this is we had everyone from 4 years old to 70 years old at the event. We did not limit it in ages, and they really learned the introductions to computer programming and just exposing them to the opportunities that are out there when it comes to digital type jobs. So they actually learned how to write computer programs using popular games like Minecraft and things like that, because you have to make it fun. So it was just a great event. And a lot of parents said, wow, my kids were here, so I thought, what the heck, I'll learn too. And so they were exposed to something they had never been exposed to as well.
Yeah, I was going to say, is this something where people just didn't have this field on their radar, whether we're talking about, you know, maybe a kid in high school or maybe an older worker? It wasn't even on the map for them?
I think it's a little bit of both of what you said. You know, I think there's a stereotype, unfortunately, that still exists out there, that a person that's a computer programmer, today we call them software developers, is the person that sits in the corner and drinks Mountain Dew and eats Cheetos, and they don't see the light of day. And that is the farthest thing from the truth of that stereotype, and you know, we get that from our Hollywood counterparts. They may be in a rural area, and you know, not all K-12 schools, number one, have the resources or the money maybe to offer these types of classes. And we just want students to be able to see, wow, this is an opportunity out there. And maybe as they get older, that they may look at doing something that's a dual credit with us. But it was important that everyone had equal opportunity to be exposed to this.
Talking to Julie Eben-Matsky from Northeast Wisconsin Technical College in Green Bay, looking at efforts there to introduce the field of information technology to more people of a wide variety of ages. Julie, you had this Hour of Code in December, 300 people you mentioned. Are there students enrolled, do you think, right now who maybe thought about this for the first time at that Hour of Code?
Absolutely. And we do a similar event that is called Girls in IT. Believe it or not, this day and age, females in that field is still a minority. And we got that event coming up in a couple of months, and we do have 100 girls here, middle school girls, that leave the day and say, wow, I didn't know this is what my dad does at work, or I didn't know this is what my cousin does at work. So we have that event coming up, but it gained such demand back in December that we decided we're going to hold our first spring event coming up here in April. So I asked people to kind of watch out for that. This time we're going to have a little bit of a different spin, and we're going to look at things like computer support. How do you fix computers, as well as cybersecurity? And we're going to do it district-wide again because that was so popular.
Can you give a little pep talk to people out there who are listening and thinking, kind of as you were saying, this isn't me. I'm not the kind of person who goes into computers, whether it's because, as you say, girls aren't often seen as the right people to do this, or older workers, whatever. What would you say to them to say, hey, maybe it is you?
Well, there's just such a broad range of opportunities in IT. It isn't just programming. It's everything from cybersecurity to maybe they're a good trainer to train people in computers. Maybe they like to fix computers. There's just such a wide range in that area. There's almost something for everyone. We even have students that they like to game. Well, why don't you put that to good use and write gaming apps? People always thought that you had to move to California to sell apps and to do gaming. Well, now we have students that sell their apps from right here in Northeast Wisconsin to companies in California. There isn't a job today that you don't need some type of computer digital literacy. And it, whether it's an auto mechanic or whatever it is, you can see what computers have done. So I encourage everyone to come out, like I said, from 4 years old to 90 years old, and just open up your mind and see what it has to offer out there. You would be amazed the number of people we have, middle-aged to older, that come back and say, you know what, I want a new career. It's time for me to retool myself for that new career. We had a recent graduate, he was an engineer. And he wanted to be a software developer and came back and got those skills.
As we wrap up, Julie, can you talk about the kind of course offerings you have at Northeast Wisconsin Technical College? I imagine probably other technical colleges around the state that would help people get started.
Absolutely. What we call our IT cluster is just a wide range of different programs that we offer. We offer everything from, like I said earlier, network security, which is a growing. All of us have seen all those ads about hacking and security problems. We offer admin support. We also offer software developer. We have web development for developing websites and web apps. We have business analyst, which is just a growing area for people that have a good business sense, as well as being able to look at analytics. We just have a wide range. If you can think about it in an IT career, we offer it here at NWTC in Green Bay.
Julie, thanks a lot for taking the time today.
Absolutely. Thank you for having me.
That's Julie Eben-Matsky, Associate Dean of Information Technology at Northeast Wisconsin Technical College in Green Bay. She was with us to talk about a recent event called Hour of Code, which aims to train people of all ages for jobs in IT. Coming up, we'll get opposing takes on President Trump's State of the Union address, and you can join in with your thoughts, your reactions to what the president had to say, and the Democratic response. You can get things going now with an email, ideas@WPR.org. Tweet us at Central Time WPR or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. Listening to Central Time, I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up tomorrow at 7 on the morning show, dueling tax plans, a growing list of lame duck lawsuits, and a budget just around the corner. Get the latest on the biggest stories in Wisconsin politics with Kate Archer Kent and her guest. That's tomorrow morning at 7 on the morning show. First, President Trump delivered his State of the Union address last night after a shutdown-related postponement. The speech featured some notes of bipartisanship. He praised the criminal justice law he signed in December, vowed to fight childhood cancer, and committed to eliminate HIV in a decade. It also included a dose of division, with attacks on socialism and abortion, a renewed pledge for a wall on the southern border, and a shot at the ongoing Russia investigation. What did you think of what Trump had to say? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. What stood out most to you? How hopeful are you that President Trump and congressional Democrats could work together? Again, 800-642-1234. Email ideas@WPR.org or tweet us at Central Time WPR. Tommy Binion is the Vice President of Congressional and Executive Branch Relations with the Heritage Foundation. Tommy, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you very much. It's great to be with you.
And Ruth Conniff is here, editor-at-large of the Progressive Magazine. Ruth, thanks for joining us.
Glad to be here.
Let's get overall reactions. And Tommy, let's start with you, your reaction to this year's State of the Union address.
Well, the State of the Union accomplishes 10 different items and serves 10 different masters. So it really depends on what you were looking for last night. But the president scored high marks with American viewers, in the 70s in terms of approval rating for the actual speech. If you look at the content, it's pretty clear that was the audience, the American people watching. and he looked like a unifier, and he looked presidential. I think that was the goal, and he accomplished it. It was clearly had a mixed reception inside the chamber, but he had a little fun with that along the way. It was an entertaining speech, and I think overall achieved his goals.
And Ruth, your overall reaction?
Well, not surprisingly, I'm not in complete agreement with Tommy on this. I don't know who those 70% were who lasted for the whole hour and a half of the speech, but you know, the promise of the speech going into it was that it was going to be a uniting speech. He was going to be a unifier. And he really, I mean, knowing Donald Trump, that was a very high bar. It was particularly a high bar coming into a chamber he'd been barred from entering and then lost the power struggle to go ahead and give the State of the Union earlier during the government shutdown. He had lost the shutdown fight itself. And so really, Trump came in at a disadvantage because his biggest obstacle was his own challenged ego. And that never puts Trump in a unifying frame of mind. So he tried. He began with a few words about we need to work together and we need to achieve greatness. And then the speech went straight into the combative attack mode that we're all so familiar with in Donald Trump. And I thought it ranged all over the place. It was a very long speech. There were a couple of truly bizarre moments. I thought that his particularly lurid and graphic descriptions of abortions, of babies being whipped from wombs and executed by doctors was a weird departure for a guy who used to support Planned Parenthood. And also just particularly ghoulish in that context. I think it was very odd when he claimed credit for the large number of women in Congress, record number this year, mostly because of the backlash against the Trump administration. I thought it was great when those women stood up and applauded, mostly facing each other, and Trump tried to kind of keep the joke going. But it seemed to me that the joke was on him. I mean, he was in a chamber that has turned against him. The midterm election was a real rebuke of him. He hasn't been able to acknowledge that and recalibrate and talk about what a bipartisan consensus would look like. And so instead, we had the same old Trump launching a lot of attacks, a lot of vitriol. And at the end of the day, you know, a whole long screed about immigrants who he equates with murderers and criminals. Very, you know, very divisive speech, very negative speech. And I think kind of a reeling Trump who that, you know, the line that will always live on from the speech, I think, is his channeling Johnny Cochran to say we can't have peace and legislation if we have war and investigation. He's worried about people investigating him. He's obviously on the ropes.
And Tommy, did you see something significant when it came to that unity goal of the speech?
Yeah, I thought it was much more than a few words at the beginning of the speech that was a mere nod to unity. I thought that the real theme of the speech were the things that Americans together can be proud of. We can be proud of the current state of the economy. We can certainly be proud of the role or what happened on the beaches of Normandy. The president appealed to our sense of historic pride that we all can share together and then applied it to this moment. What are we going to accomplish next? I thought that the overall message of the speech, and that goes for just about every section. The beginning, he brought it back around in the end, but just about every section was an appeal to things that we can all agree on. I don't agree that the section on immigration was an attack on immigrants. I think it was a realistic look at a national crisis, something that we all ought to be worried about. And no, he's not talking about immigrants and calling them murderers. He's talking about violent gangs which control the flow of illegal immigrants on the border. This is something that has us all concerned. This isn't political rhetoric. This is something that Americans are concerned about. I think just about every section was gave something for everybody to worry about. He talked about drug prices. He talked about education. He talked about trade. He talked about the economy. All of this is something we all have a stake in. I didn't view the congratulatory tone in terms of the record number of women in Congress as political at all. I thought that he was celebrating a moment in American history. I think if you view it through a partisan lens, you could come to those conclusions. But I genuinely think the president's team, and indeed he himself, sat down to think about what is it that we can all agree on. Now, I'm speaking about everyday Americans watching this on TV on their couch in their basement. I'm not talking about the people in the chamber who view everything through a hyper-partisan lens. It's no surprise that they heard a divisive message, but I don't think that was the message that was delivered. And I think that's why the response from those polled last night was so universally positive.
Talking about the State of the Union address last night, Tommy Binion with us from the Heritage Foundation, Ruth Conniff from the Progressive Magazine. Want to key in on something we haven't talked about as much so far today here on the Ideas Network. Foreign policy in North Korea, the president announcing a new summit with North Korean leader Kim Jong-un scheduled for the end of the month. He praised his administration's handling of the North Korean issue. Here's a listen.
Our hostages have come home. Nuclear testing has stopped. And there has not been a missile launch in more than 15 months. If I had not been elected president of the United States, we would right now, in my opinion, be in a major war with North Korea.
A lot of attention to North Korea over the last couple of years. Ruth, your reaction to the president's statement there.
I mean, this was typical of Trump in that he was claiming personal credit for preventing the deaths of millions of Americans in a war that he alleges would have taken place with North Korea were he not in office. It's preposterous, but it's very typical of him. The overblown rhetoric, the fact that it focuses entirely on him, Trump, the individual, as the savior. And that was the tone of a lot of the speech. I mean, I don't think anybody thinks that we would have been in a war with North Korea under President Obama. I think a lot of people were worried we might start a war with North Korea under Trump. And there was kind of a relief that he backed off from his very provocative rhetoric early on in his administration. But, you know, these were very conclusory statements that he made repeatedly and mostly centering on him, Donald Trump, as the savior. And I just have to say to Tommy, like, the idea that Donald Trump is a nonpartisan unifying figure and that it's all the other people around him who are hyping up partisanship is just, it's just so counterfactual. It's really hard to bother to argue with it. The man is an enormously polarizing figure, an enormously self-aggrandizing figure. And I think a lot of what makes people very, very nervous in this country about what our future holds is that he seems to operate almost entirely from anxiety about what's going to happen to him individually and not concern for the great majority of people. On that working class issue, working class people and immigration, Trump really played that note. He laid it out very clearly. He sees immigration, particularly undocumented immigrants, as something that working class people are worried about. And he says that because he is a right-wing populist, and scapegoating immigrants has been a key to his election and his success. So when he holds up a family who, you know, where the grandparents were allegedly murdered by an undocumented immigrant, what he doesn't say is that the Washington Post just did a long story on how much lower the violent crime rate is among undocumented immigrants. So the idea that there's this huge threat to our safety, he wants to stir that up, and he wants people to be afraid and angry. But the reality is not there, and 60% of Americans in the last Gallup poll said they oppose his border wall. So I don't think the people are with him.
And Tommy, your reaction to the North Korea part of the speech?
Yeah, well, I mean, Ruth is right that Donald Trump is a rather polarizing figure, but I think that the content of the address itself is neutral. And that explains why 76% of people approved of it, because it was an appeal to something we can all agree on. North Korea is no different than that, right? I think we're all relieved that tensions with North Korea are much lower than they were 3, 4, 5, 6 years ago. I really do think we were all anxious about that, and we're all relieved, and we're all relieved to hear that that is a trend that's going to continue with a summit next month. I don't think Americans are overly worried about who gets the credit for it. I think they're just glad it happened. I think they're tired of us fighting about who gets the credit for it. I think that that they're glad that we don't seem to be in any sort of imminent danger where it concerns North Korea, and I think that they want those trends to continue.
We're getting reaction to President Trump's State of the Union address. Tommy Binion is with us, along with Ruth Conniff. Tommy with the Heritage Foundation, Ruth with the Progressive Magazine. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What did you think of the president's speech last night? Do you have a question you want to throw out there for our guests? Call 800-642-1234 or tweet us at Central Time WPR. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're talking about last night's State of the Union address with our guests and with you. Ruth Conniff is editor-at-large with Progressive. Tommy Binion, vice president of Congressional Executive Branch Relations with the Heritage Foundation. You can join in with your reactions and questions at 800-642-1234. We'll go right to your calls now. We've got Jeff with us in Frederick. Jeff, hi.
Hi. To me, what I noticed wasn't so much what the speech was about, was about the behavior of the Democratic women dressed in white. To me, it didn't matter what Trump was talking about, whether it was the strong economy or American pride or protecting our borders or the unborn. But the only time those women showed any kind of emotion was when they were able to acknowledge themselves to stand up and give themselves a round of applause.
Jeff, thanks a lot for the call. I'm a radio person. I listened. I didn't watch. But Ruth, your thoughts on what he had to say.
I mean, people saw reflected in that speech in that room sort of where they were originally. And I'm guessing that our caller is a Trump supporter who was not a huge Nancy Pelosi fan to begin with. But what I saw those Democratic women do is sit on their hands when Trump said that we're going to have an economy that's dependent on oil and fracking. And when he said that, you know, made that long, gory description of late-term abortion, and stand up and applaud when he said that women's workforce participation has increased, and then remain standing when he said there were more women than ever in Congress. So do I think that that was bad behavior? Absolutely not.
And Tommy, your reaction to some of the visuals we saw during the speech?
Yeah, well, I think what the American people are most frustrated about, they know that the Democrats hate the president. They're aware. They want them to get over it and work on solutions, right? So we just witnessed a government shutdown, 35 days, where it wasn't about the policy of border security. For decades, Democrats have supported a wall on the southern border. But when Trump proposes it, suddenly it's immoral. So I think the frustration that you're hearing in the caller there is that, yes, we know that the Democrats dislike President Trump, but they want them to get over it and find a way to work on policy. It's almost as if the most important thing to them is the personality of Donald Trump. And I think that the American people want the most important thing to the people elected to represent them to be the policies that benefit them. And I think their behavior last night was colored way more by Donald Trump's personality than the policies he was proposing. I find that to be rather disappointing.
Ruth, personality, Trump, not policy?
No. Trump owns the government shutdown. He said it very explicitly. He said it repeatedly. It was his shutdown. And he didn't get what he wanted. And he held 800,000 federal workers hostage. And a lot of those people really suffered, something he did not mention once in his speech last night. Nobody thinks that the Democrats caused the government shutdown. They simply didn't cave in to his blackmail. And as far as the border wall, I would be interested, Tommy, to see you produce a Democratic proposal for a massive multi-billion-dollar wall all along the southern border of the United States. I mean, there's some real potential for bipartisan agreement on border security and a rational program to deal with the existing undocumented immigrants who prop up industries in this country. And Republicans and Democrats alike know that that's true. Here in Wisconsin, more than 50% of the labor on dairy farms is done by undocumented workers. So we need to acknowledge that reality and get somewhere with that. I think that's absolutely true. But the idea that somehow the Democrats are the barrier to that, and that Donald Trump, if only they would bend to his will when he held 800,000 people hostage to put up a medieval wall along the southern border, that would be the solution. I think it doesn't pass the smell test, and that's why 60% of Americans are against it.
Quick response, Tommy, before we go to another caller.
Yeah, I think the Democrats have long supported the Secure Fence Act of 2006 is the example that you asked for. They have long supported. They funded during the government shutdown what the president was asking for, which is not a medieval wall. It's a modern structure aimed at border security. He's now asking for steel slats. They supported it before he proposed it. Now they oppose it.
I mean, the wall's a joke, and he's changed from concrete to steel. He's moved all over the map on it, but it's basically a talking point from his campaign, and it's a trigger to say, you know, we don't want these immigrants, and we're going to keep them out. But as far as actual policy, real, concrete, rational policy goes, he's not even going to the table for that discussion.
I want to bring on another caller or two before we run out of time. Ruth is with us in Milton. Ruth, hi.
Hi. I wanted to mention that he did do a lengthy part about the American role in World War II and introduced Holocaust survivors, which was a good thing. However, he has encouraged the rise of neo-Nazism in this country. And essentially, if we don't pay attention, it's destroying this country from within. I would especially like for his supporters to think about his split thoughts. Maybe he was sincere about the survivors, but nothing can excuse that he supports Nazism.
Ruth, thanks for the call. Tommy, do you want to tackle that?
I'd be happy to. The president does not support Nazism, and I find that accusation to be rather upsetting. The president has been one of the most, actually the most pro-Israel president in recent memory. His son-in-law and his daughter, Jared, are Jewish. He does not support Nazism, and I don't think we can allow an accusation like that to stand. All of the evidence points in quite the opposite direction. And so I'm not sure the nature of the question other than to call the president a Nazi or to at least call him a Nazi supporter. And I find that to be a rather abhorrent accusation.
Ruth Conniff?
Well, I think part of the reason that the caller makes that assertion is because the president called the neo-Nazi protesters in Charlottesville very fine people. And I think that he has conducted a campaign in which he knows that there is a very aggressive right-wing white supremacist base that supports him. And he's been winking at that base the entire time he's been in office. So there's no doubt. I mean, this is why, you know, although he was able to find one person to come from Squirrel Hill from the synagogue massacre there, most of the people in that synagogue really insisted that he not come to their town because a lot of Jews think that Donald Trump is a dangerous figure who represents some very creepy elements in society that are very anti-Semitic. It's true the right-wing government of Israel likes him, and Bibi Netanyahu has big billboards of himself shaking hands with Donald Trump, who moved the U.S. Embassy to Jerusalem there. It's a very provocative move. But at the same time, within the United States, he is supported by people who have some really retrograde racist and anti-Semitic views, and he knows that.
Let's bring on one more caller, Tom in Madison. Tom, hi.
Hi, how are you?
Good. Briefly, what did you want to bring up, Tom?
Yeah, real quick. The figure that keeps getting cited by Tommy is the 70% or 70-some percent of viewers that approved of the speech. And I need to point out that, you know, me as a person who generally watches the State of the Union address could not stomach even 5 minutes of watching Donald Trump stroke his own ego last night. And I have a feeling that the majority, the vast majority of the people who were able to watch that speech were his own base of supporters. And that's why you've got a number that's up around 70%.
I have the same feeling.
Tom, thanks for the call. Tommy, a self-selecting sample, briefly?
No, I don't think so. That's a CBS News poll. I believe that they use scientifically accepted methods to make sure that it's representative of the American people. And if you'd only watched 5 minutes of the speech, I'm not sure that you can appropriately judge it. I think that if the question is about the legitimacy of the poll, I refer you to CBS News.
No, I think the question is about how many people can hang in for an hour and a half of Donald Trump blowing his own horn, and I think it's probably true it's a pretty self-selecting group.
All right, very briefly, 10 seconds each. Tommy, does a State of the Union address really matter?
Absolutely it matters. I think that millions of Americans watched it, and I think that it matters. It changes the legislative agenda for the next year. I think that our president talking to our Congress is an important event, and we ought to pay attention.
And Ruth, does it matter?
I agree that it matters, and I think that that Stacey Abrams' historic rebuttal also matters, and I think we see which way things are moving in the country as a result.
Ruth, thanks for joining us today.
Glad to be here.
And Tommy, thanks a lot for taking the time.
You betcha.
That's Ruth Conniff, editor-at-large at The Progressive, and Tommy Binion, vice president of congressional and executive branch relations with the Heritage Foundation. They both joined us for a look at last night's State of the Union address. You can keep weighing in over on the Ideas Network Facebook page.